This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the great constitutional attorney Michael Tiger on the decline of democracy and the rule of law. It's been accelerated, particularly with the advent of the Republicans and the Trump administration. Aaron Sorkin's movie, The Trial of the Chicago 7, is up now on Netflix. The chief attorneys at the trial were William Kunstler and Leonard Weinglass. We have a special treat for you today because we're going to play Kunstler's comedy routine at Caroline's Comedy Club, where he talks about the trial of the Chicago 7.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Democracy and the rule of law have been in decline long before the Trump administration came into office. The decline is accelerating. We can trace it all the way back at least 19 years to the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. The Patriot Act resulted and put in place the surveillance state, making American people the most spied-on people in history. The Supreme Court decision in Citizens United allowed for dark money, guided by the right-wing Federalist Society, to pack the federal judiciary with 200-plus Trump-appointed right-wing judges, Amy Comey Barrett being the latest. Local police forces have been militarized, and we have seen the results of this with the Black Lives Matter uprisings since June. The attack on democracy has been bipartisan. The Obama administration claimed the right to assassinate anyone without due process, including American citizens, even children. They put more whistleblowers in prison than ever before. Trump initiated the unprecedented prosecution of Julian Assange, a whistleblowing publisher who exposed the U.S. war crimes. Now Trump, with the backing of the Republican Party and the gun-toting militias, have promised not to honor the results of the upcoming election if he loses. We speak today with constitutional attorney Michael Tiger. He's a professor emeritus from the Washington College of Law and has taught at the University of Texas, Duke University, and lectured widely around the world. He's been in private practice before the Supreme Court, arguing his first case when he was 24 years old. Tiger has written and edited more than a dozen important books, including The Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power and the seminal Law and the Rise of Capitalism. Since 1996, Michael Tiger has practiced law with his wife, Jane B. Tiger. Michael Tiger, a great pleasure to welcome you back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Amy Comey Barrett clerked for the deceased Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. He called himself an originalist. So does she. She was asked at her confirmation hearings by Lindsey Graham to explain what she meant by calling herself an originalist, and she replied, quote, "That means that I interpret the Constitution as a law, that I interpret its text as a text, and I understand it to have the meaning that it had at the time people ratified it." I wanted to ask you what your opinion is of originalism. My own is that it's a slick rhetorical maneuver to privilege one's own views as objectively primary. What do you think of originalism?
Well, I can't use one word. BS, I guess. That's not one of the seven Pacifica words. It's nonsense because it is utterly unfaithful to the intent of the framers and to the history of the common law tradition. The people who wrote the Constitution inherited their legal ideas about interpretation from what had happened in England during the 17th century in the English Revolution. And at that time, the notion was that one looked back to old texts, such as Magna Carta, to establish the idea that government power must be accountable, and accountable at the instance of citizens who claimed an injustice, but that the application in particular cases had to take account of what was going on at that particular time. That was the interpretive tradition that the framers of the Constitution understood at the time they wrote it. And Chief Justice Marshall said that. He said, we must not forget it is a Constitution we are expounding. So Amy Coney Barrett and Antonin Scalia have been perpetrating this fraud, which is simply a way of interposing mythologies, to flag my own book, as a way of justifying reactionary judicial decisions.
We're talking about mythologies of state and monopoly power. Monthly Review put it out a while ago. Michael was the guest on Law and Disorder to talk about that book, and we're going to talk about that in a moment, Michael, but I wanted to continue with this line of thought on Amy Coney Barrett. With Barrett on the Supreme Court, the reactionaries, all right-wing Catholics, have a majority. How will this affect upcoming cases like the legality of Obamacare, or gay marriage, or the right of a woman to control her own body?
Well, I think that people are predicting that the court may very well overrule Roe versus Wade, that the court may very well invalidate the Affordable Care Act. We don't know the answer to that. I don't think that's a done deal. There are instances of Republican-appointed judges and justices who have disappointed the president who appointed them. But certainly that's the fear. But I want to signal something else to people about this. This administration has populated the federal district courts and courts of appeals with these unqualified reactionary ideologues. And what I think that the impact over time on the rights of people who go to court to try to get redress for police violence, who may get a jury verdict in their favor and have it overturned by these reactionary district judges, we're going to see something that is reminiscent of what happened beginning in 1960. After Brown v. Board of Education, the federal district judges in the American South resisted the teaching of Brown. And that then led to this upsurge that began with the sit-in movement and then the direct action movement. We're going to see more and more people realizing that it is time to get back into the streets and to seek to make those who are exercising power aware of what needs to happen.
Leonard Leo has up until recently headed up the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is responsible for selecting judges that the Republican Senate will then push through. Over 200 federal judges have been put in place recently in the lower appellate and the Supreme Court. Leonard Leo is in a group called Opus Dei. That's Latin for God's work. Opus Dei was founded in 1928 by a Spanish fascist priest who was also an attorney. Is there such a thing as fascist jurisprudence?
Well, of course, there is such a thing as fascist jurisprudence, but to return to the book that I wrote, Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power, before any government gets to overt fascism, it employs the myth of procedural regularity to mask by a series of mythological-type assertions what's really going on underneath. And they do that with in analyzing and picking apart jury verdicts. They use the myth of freedom of contract. They use the myth of so-called equal opportunity as a cover for what's really going on. Now, turning back to Opus Dei, it's certainly true that and other reactionary organizations have begun to have an extraordinary influence on the writing and thinking of some of these justices.
There are some 260 million Christians in America. A quarter of them are evangelical Christians like Amy Coney Barrett. It's clear that the evangelicals prevailed upon Trump to nominate her. Constitutional attorney Michael Ripps, in his forthcoming book, Objection, argues that because the Constitution clearly states that no religious test can be used to appoint a judge, and that because the evangelical Christian lobby got Trump to nominate Barrett, that therefore an injunction could be gotten to prevent her from taking her seat. What do you think of that argument?
Well, where would you go to get the injunction?
And who would bring it?
Yes. Well, you'd have to bring it to these federal courts that are increasingly dominated by Trump appointees. Now, I don't think such a thing has legs. And underneath it all, you know, right now, the people who are progressives in the United States of America need to be thinking not so much about the kinds of injunctions that they might or might not get, but that the kinds of direct action that we all need to take. What's been moving the dialogue these days is this impressive upwelling of protest about racism, homophobia, and all the other list of concerns that people legitimately have. It's people in motion that are going to make changes, not lawyers filing motions.
What did you think of Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse's presentation at the Barrett hearings? He proved that dark money is behind the appointments of over 200 judges to the federal judiciary, and that organizations funded by this dark money encouraged plaintiffs to file lawsuits challenging laws that they didn't like. Then they wrote the briefs in support of these challenges, and then the cases went to the judges that they had influence in putting on the bench to begin with. What did you think when Sheldon Whitehouse made that presentation?
I thought it was brilliant, and it takes us back to Citizens United. Once the Supreme Court gets this crazy idea, which was shared even by liberal members of the court, that money is speech, and that therefore the use of money to influence political elections is virtually immune from any kind of limitation, you will then see the positions in the United States Senate filled by people who are elected by this means, and you will also and see its influence on presidential elections. So that the process of choosing who will be nominated and the process of choosing how those nominations will be confirmed by the Senate is dominated by these billions of dollars of cash that are flowing into the process. Thus, we go back once again to this malign influence of money. And I think that's what the senator was very ably showing us.
To stop right-wing majority from trampling on our rights, some people have proposed that the Supreme Court needs to be packed. Others, like the late historian Howard Zinn, have argued that massive political protests in the streets and pressure like that is what historically has preserved our liberties. Your thoughts about that, please.
I think Zinn is right. Take a look at what happened in the Supreme Court as a result of the movement that began in Greensboro on February 1st, 1960, the sit-in and direct action movement. The majority of justices, with a couple of outlier kind of dissents, woke up and recognized that these upwellings of support were not only to be not sanctioned or subject to criminal prosecution, but were necessary parts of a process that had to take place. And that honeymoon with the direct action movement didn't last all that many years. But, I mean, I think he's right. What, Finley Peter Dunne's character, Mr. Dooley, was that back at near the turn of the 20th century? The Supreme Court reads the election returns, said Mr. Dooley, and I think that's right.
Whistleblowing Australian publisher Julian Assange is a computer genius. He figured out a way for whistleblowers to anonymously leak confidential information that compromised and embarrassed the U.S. government. For example, he exposed American war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. And even though he was not a U.S. citizen when he's not working in the United States, the Trump administration has charged him with espionage and seeks to extradite him from England and then try him in the Eastern District of Virginia, where he'll likely be found guilty. What do you make of this American global reach? And is this global reach a one-way street? I'm thinking of the Kiobel case, where a non-American citizen attempted and failed to use the American court system.
Well, now you first, the this last part of your question signals the hypocrisy of it all. Because in Kill Bill, Chief Justice Roberts says, well, the United States doesn't make laws for the world. Well, right. And again, that's one of the essays in that book that I wrote, Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power. But the second part is turning directly to the Assange case. Ever since 1917, when the Espionage Act was first passed, the Congress has resolutely instructed the President of the United States by legislative history and statutory text that the Espionage Act was not designed to apply to journalistic activity and was not to be used in ways that infringe the First Amendment. The Assange case represents, therefore, an application of the Espionage Act to journalistic activity that has only been tolerated for one brief period in American history, and that's the prosecution of a naval historian named Samuel Morrison. And in Morrison's case, even though he was prosecuted, a later administration publicly pardoned him as an acknowledgement that the application of the statute to him was wrong. So what we have in the Assange case is this administration treading upon ground that has always been thought protected by the First Amendment, and in violation of the consistent interpretation of the Espionage Act. Not only that, we see this as a part of a pattern, which unfortunately began some of it during the Obama administration, that these whistleblower activities that have exposed American war crimes and other illegalities are being targeted deliberately by the government to discourage this sort of thing. You know, Wole Soyinka, the Nigerian poet, says, the truth shall set you free? Well, maybe, but first the truth must be set free. And I think that's got to be the theme.
Michael Tiger, you've got a new book coming out in Monthly Review Press. Can you give us a preview of the book, please?
Sure. Yeah, well, thank you. The book is to be called Sensing Injustice. It is a memoir of 50, now approaching 60 years, in the battle for change. And I hope it's not simply an exercise in ego. It is designed to say, particularly to this generation of people, young lawyers, law students, and others, to talk to them about the ways in which our sense of injustice can propel us into effective advocacy in court and out of court to make change. It's been a refreshing and interesting opportunity to look back on things that have been going on in the United States during the past five decades.
Well, let's circle back, if we might, to your last book, Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power. The repressive state and monopoly power preserves the forms of legal redress while eviscerating the substance. That's what you wrote to me, and I think that's certainly true. The aim is to preclude accountability for abuses of power. And I wanted to ask you if you could elaborate on that and give us some examples of these mythologies and why they're important.
Right now, one major issue is this issue of accountability for police violence. There's a federal statute that dates to the post-Civil War era that permits us to sue police officers who violate the constitutional rights of people, for example, by beating the snot out of them in the public streets. And the courts, however, have eviscerated much of that statute by holding that the officers in question have qualified immunity, and they cannot be held liable unless they violated a clearly established constitutional right. And the clearly established descends to levels of particularity that means that the right must not only have been recognized in general, such as free speech, free press, free association, but there must be specific language in specific Supreme Court cases that define the violation of the right that this person suffered in particular terms. Thus, in case after case, attempts to establish responsibility for police violence have come a cropper. And that is simply one example, and indeed it is an example that has led the present House of Representatives to have legislation before it that would abolish this defense of qualified immunity. I give a whole bunch of other examples in the book, which was a series of essays that were kind of fun to write. But that's the basic idea. I mean, I start by saying, for example, during the Reign of Terror, as the guillotine blade descended and the head went into the basket, the crier would cry, "In the name of the French people, justice is done." Well, justice wasn't being done at all. What was being done is somebody's having their head chopped off. Justice was a name given to the process of beheading in the interest of the state.
That's a wonderful example. Are there any others you might want to share with us?
Well, there is an essay about the separate but equal. In the late 1940s, an African-American, Haman Sweat, applied for and was accepted to the University of Texas Law School. And he showed up. And, oh my goodness, he was African-American. And it was a segregated school. So they said, no, he couldn't enroll. But he sued. And Texas responded by establishing a separate but equal law school that didn't have any books, didn't have a library, didn't have full-time professors, didn't have a law review, but it was called the Texas Law School for Negroes. And the good lawyers for the state of Texas argued all the way to the Supreme Court that this law school was equal in every material respect to the University of Texas Law School. And indeed, the dean of that law school, Charles McCormick, he McCormick on evidence, the lawyers are recognized, testified under oath that that was so. Well, the Supreme Court of the United States had their crap detectors strapped on pretty tightly and decided that this was nonsense. But the fact is that for years, these responsible lawyers went ahead and argued this as though it ought to be taken seriously. And they quoted the former president of the Harvard University, who supported the view that, quote, maybe in a couple of hundred years, when Negroes among us have learned the lessons of civilization, then they can have equal rights. This man, by the way, had been president of Harvard at the time that W.E.B. Du Bois had gotten his Ph.D. degree. I mean, let's examine that statement for just a minute as exemplifying what I'm talking about. What do you mean after a few hundred years they would understand the lessons of civilization? You mean the civilization that enslaved people by bringing them in chains into the United States and then resisted the abolition of slavery and the restoration of any kinds of equal rights? This is the mythology that underlies a lot of reactionary thinking.
You've been involved, as Heidi and I have, in supporting attorney Stephen Donziger. He's been ruined, disbarred, and faces prison. He had secured a multi-billion dollar judgment against Texaco, a huge oil company, which polluted an expanse of the Amazon that was comparable in its size to the state of Rhode Island, and it caused terrible sickness and hardship to the indigenous people in that area. What's the status of the Donziger case now?
Donziger is going to go on trial for contempt of court. Let's go back a bit. Chevron in Ecuador committed environmental depredation that was many times more serious as a matter of the human and social and environmental cost than the BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico. He got a judgment. Chevron fought back by falsely claiming that the judgment had been obtained by means of fraud. They brought that case in the United States, and then the judge did a three-card Monty sort of thing that deprived Donziger of his right to a civil jury, to a jury trial. And Judge Kaplan, notoriously biased in favor of Chevron, entered a judgment that Donziger had somehow brought this lawsuit fraudulently. Well, having got that judgment, he then ordered Donziger to produce information concerning the his clients and information with respect to them. Donziger refused to provide that information, and the judge has now cited him for criminal contempt. Now, because there are six counts of criminal contempt, each of which is said to be a maximum of 6 months of incarceration, the judge said, well, he's not entitled to a jury trial. So now the case goes out to Chief Judge Preska, who will try it. She says that he must submit to a virtual criminal trial. That is to say, he's got to be tried on television. even though the opportunity to cross-examine under those circumstances and the violation of the constitutional right of public trial ought to be evident. But the most important thing about the case, Michael, is this, that the information that Donziger refuses to provide is information about the people of who are in Ecuador. None of those people has ever been given a hearing as to whether or not their private information could be required to be disclosed to the world. I mean, even if Donziger wanted to do it, his obligation as a lawyer is not to do it unless the clients consent to it. This is the most basic principle of American law. That is to say, you cannot be condemned to give up something, including your private information, until you've had a full and fair opportunity to be heard. I need to take a breath here. The list of outrages being committed by this judge lengthens every day. Mind you, Judge Kaplan asked the United States Attorney to prosecute Donziger, and they refused. So the judge has now appointed a private prosecutor whose law firm has connections with Chevron. One cannot imagine a more unseemly and disgusting broth of violation of basic constitutional principles.
He also tried to get him disbarred, and the referee who heard the case refused to do it. But that didn't stop the judge, did it?
No, it certainly didn't. And by the way, Donziger is now being held with an electronic monitoring bracelet with house arrest going on 2 years now. Dare say never in the history of United States courts has anyone charged with a petty offense, I mean, this is like a traffic violation, been held virtually without bail for such a period of time.
What kind of outcry has there been? Who's come to Donziger's defense?
Well, Scott Badenoch, Badenoch, a prominent environmental lawyer, is leading a monitoring committee that is speaking up on his behalf. He's assembled a group of lawyers and environmental activists to protest, to observe the court, and well-known old-time civil rights, civil liberties lawyer Martin Garbus has written the most pointed letter to the judge, arraigning all of her procedural irregularities and also those of the judge who referred the case, who are Judge Kaplan. So, creditably, a lot of people have spoken up.
What's the next step in Donziger's defense? What do you think is going to happen?
I can't predict at this point. The judge disqualified his longtime lawyer, Rick Friedman. He's been forced to scramble for counsel. The lawyer that he's found, a very capable lawyer without much experience in federal criminal defense, Lauren Reagan, her doctor and everybody says, gee, she should not travel to New York to be with her client to try the case because of the COVID-19 fears. The judge has said, well, that's all right. You can represent him by television. And Ron Kuby, who used to be partners with Bill Kunstler, has bravely said he will take the case on if the judge will just grant a brief continuance to let him finish up another matter that he's working on. And she has resolutely refused. In orders that have referred to Donziger in terms that make clear that she's already made up her mind. So let's hope that the judge grants a modest continuance and Ron Kuby can get in the case and start raising some of these issues.
Has there been any kind of international outcry or organization of international lawyers on this?
Yes. Creditably, lawyers involved in international environmental organizations have spoken up, made their views clear.
It says something about the reputation that the United States is getting globally, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. The activities of the Trump administration are just the beginning. And year by year, we see that the reputation of the United States as a place to which one would look for the definition and enforcement of rights has declined precipitously.
Michael Tiger, let me ask you a very broad question having to do with the book that you wrote years ago, and then it was updated, called Law and the Rise of Capitalism. You wrote that book, I don't know, 30 years ago or so?
Well, that's 1971, so So how many years ago is that?
49, almost as old as us. It was an extremely important book when it came out. Nothing like it had ever existed. I remember reading it very closely, and then I read it again when it came out again. And you argue that early capitalism played a revolutionary role in the overthrow of feudalism. Capitalism as an economic system only began about 1,000 years ago. And now it's changed into what we would call monopoly capitalism. And I wanted to ask you a very broad question. How has monopoly capitalism changed the law? Could you reflect on that, please?
Oh, my goodness. Well, we can start with the fact that the institution of the imperial expression of monopoly capital has created a situation in which the economic domination of the Third World, which began in the form of colonies, has continued to this day and is a focus of social struggle. The Monthly Review has written an article about the Global Reserve Army of Labor that points out this problem. We all know it because we wear tennis shoes and T-shirts, and we have smartphones, all of which are made under often deplorable conditions of work in places in the Third World. As the Third World peasantry is increasingly recruited into an army of wage laborers, replicating on an international basis the sort of thing that was happening in England in the early 1700s. So that's the first thing. The struggle for worker rights is these days a global struggle. And foreign policy is directed towards protecting and preserving the interests of monopoly institutions in the metropolitan countries. The second part is the pandemic influence of monopoly capital in important areas of the national economy, such as the control of the sources of information. Citizens United is just one aspect of that. We could spend hours talking about this. I'm glad you signaled the Law and the Rise of Capitalism. It was a book that was interesting to write. I did it at a time when the question of the viability of legal analysis was being asked by a lot of people. And I'm very glad to see it. It's been translated into a lot of languages, and I hope it still repays study.
How can people follow your work, Michael Tiger? You used to have a blog. Tell us what that is and tell us about what you're working on now and how people can connect with it.
I used to have a blog, and it's still out there somewhere. I haven't posted on it much. I turned my attention to writing Sensing Injustice as a way of talking about not just looking at the past, but looking at what we might do here and now. You can go to Monthly Review magazine and look at a series of articles that I've written, a couple of them in concert with my friend John Mage, over the last number of years. You just click by author and look at that's some of the work about which I'm most happy as I deal with some of these issues. You can also follow some of the work in the Assange case. My wife Jane and I did an expert witness report there, and that's been reported in the press. But, Michael, I want to say this. You know, you too have been an activist. There's so many people listening out there. It's interesting to read about what other people do, but what I want to say to people is each of us should get up right now where we are and think about what we ought to do, because it doesn't, quote, take a village. It's just going to take all of us agitating for change.
Well, how do you think we got to where we are? And talk a bit more, would you please, about what you think people should be doing.
How we got where we are is a longer conversation than we can have. Right now, the most impressive thing that has happened is based on the Black Lives Movement. And what has the deep, deep racist elements in our society that have been exposed and discussed as a part of that movement. We have not had a coalescence of people around issues related to racism and racial violence in our country for decades. So in your community, in everybody's community that's listening, there are organizations that are working to address those issues. The second thing that's going on, obviously, has to do with our very survival. That is, the anti-science rhetoric of this administration and its members and apologists isn't just designed to kill us all with this terrible virus. It is designed to mask and discredit the movement that's coalesced around these issues of climate change. Everybody's community, there are ways to work on that. So look around.
Michael, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time here, but I don't...
You mean on the time on the radio?
You think we're running out of pavement in the other sense also, huh? Michael Tiger, it's been a great pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder again. Can you give us your final thoughts?
I follow on from where I was just a few minutes ago. We, in all of our communities, there are opportunities to get out there and speak up and say what we have in mind. And I hope that everybody who's listening will now look around and seize on those opportunities and take them forward. That's not very eloquent. But if you need more suggestions, take a look at Mythologies of State and Monopoly Power. Take a look at what Monthly Review has been writing in its latest issues. You know, we'll see you on the virtual picket lines.
Michael Tiger, a great pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. You be safe and take it easy.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Shortly before he died, Bill Kunstler made an appearance at Caroline's Comedy Club. He was introduced by Randy Credico, and he spoke about the trial of the Chicago Seven. Interestingly, Bill was sentenced to 7 years in prison for contempt by Judge Hoffman, and Len Weinglass, co-counsel, was sentenced to 3 years. The founder of our radio show, Law and Disorder, Michael Ratner, wrote the brief that got these cases dismissed. The case was thrown out. The government was told that they could retry it, but they declined to do it, and everybody got off. We go now to hear the presentation by Bill Kunstler in 1995 at Caroline's Comedy Club in New York City.
I would like to talk about Jerry Garcia, but there's another soul swirling around in the air here, and that's Abby Hoffman. And Abby was with Jerry most of the time we were at Woodstock. And Abby gave me, of course, the high points of my legal life. It also got me 4 years and 13 days in jail. But you can forgive friends for that. I couldn't have done that standing on my head. Fortunately, I got out in 2 weeks on $15,000 bail, and the conviction was eventually reversed. But we sat for 7 months in a courtroom on the 23rd floor of the federal building in Chicago. How I got there is because Jerry Lefcourt and I met at the Motel on the Mountain off the thruway here, and we flipped a coin. Who would go to the Panther 21 trial? They were accused of what the Islamics are accused of now, blowing up everybody and killing everybody. That was last year's villains. And who would go to Chicago? And I don't know whether I won or lost, but I found myself on Dearborn Avenue in Chicago, and he found himself down at 100 Center Street in Manhattan. But during that trial, I learned a lot about life, believe me. Among other things, we had a fellow named Jerry Rubin, again swirling around here in the Netherland, and Abby, and I sat with these guys for 7 months. And I knew both of them before, but I didn't know deeply what great moments and ideas they had. When I first got to Chicago, I met them, and they said, "We have developed a pill that that makes men tear off women's clothes and vice versa. It is the aphrodisiac of all aphrodisiacs. I said, that's fine. I made up a legal case. They said, well, you got to show us and come with us to a loft we have on one of the side streets. We're going to make money with this pill. I walked in, they had cameras, they had wall-to-wall reporters, and they had two young couples. They brought out glasses of water, they handed out the pills, the couple drank the pills, and began to claw at each other. They had to be carried out virtually in extremis from that place, and then the pills were sold for $10 a pill. After the reporters left, probably running home with their pills, I saw in the corner a tremendous box marked Bayer aspirin. I said, what's that box? I thought that's what they carried the pills in. They said, that's what we sold, Bayer aspirin. The name seemed right, but he said, we made $1,400 and we could pay the first month's rent at our headquarters during the trial. But during the trial, every day, they brought to the table envelopes filled with hair. Apparently the yippies had sent out a circular, and there may be people old enough here who have gotten some of these circulars, though I doubt it. And in the circular it said, send hair for Jerry and for Julius. Now Julius was the judge, Julius Hoffman. He was as bald as a coot, short, looked and sounded like Mr. Magoo. This is a Chicago courtroom, and so on. We don't have singing when Judy Collins was trying to sing in a Chicago courtroom. In any event, and Jerry had been shaved at Santa Rita Prison doing a 40-day stint for some demonstration. So every day the envelopes came in. Address, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, or Judge Hoffman, care of the United States Marshal Service, Federal Building, Chicago, Illinois. And we'd open them. And we had all sorts of kind of questions going on. What part of the body was this from? Male or female? And so on. I opened one of my envelopes one day, and instead of hair, there was a noxious substance, green sort of vegetative material, which my practice knows to recognize as cannabis, or marijuana, to put it in the vernacular, forbidden by 18 U.S.C. 541 D.A.3. So I said to Jerry and Abby, for Christ's sake, we're surrounded by FBI agents, the judge, marshals, clerks, the press is sitting all over the place. What should we do with this grass? They said, throw a copy of the Chicago Tribune over it, and no one will notice. So I did that. And I sweated it out until 5 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, I said, boys, let's get our asses out of this courtroom. Jerry said, what about the grass? I said, what do you mean, what about the grass? Leave it here. Maybe the cleaning people will get it, or the marshals will find it and pin it on someone else. I'll take the envelope so there'll be no fingerprints. They said, bullshit. Make a motion, they said. Get that grass. We're not going to leave good cannabis in the United States courthouse. I said, boy, you're asking me to do a heavy thing. I'm 51 years old. I've never spent a lot of time in day jail for drugs yet. They said, get a motion. Get on your feet. So I got up and I said, Judge Hoffman, courtesy of your marshal service, there's been deposited on our table a supply of cannabis forbidden by 18 U.S.C. 541D32. I asked, what should we do with it? The judge peered down at me and said, well, you're a resourceful lawyer, Mr. Kunstler. I'm sure you'll know how to dispose of it. I said, Your Honor, it will be burnt tonight. We beat it out of the courtroom, into the men's room on the 23rd floor, where equitable division was made. We had the only legal grass in the United States. I was so filled with those memories that all I can remember is Abby pole vaulting in every day. He would do a handstand over the rail that separates spectators from the well of the court, or walking in with Jerry in judge's robes. And when you opened them up, there was a Chicago police uniform on. They had the Jewish stars on the robes that the Germans used to tag Jews with in the Third Reich. They were everywhere in that trial. When the judge said that he had practiced law in New York at one time and knew all about the big city, Abby said that must have been when the British had it. So they upstaged the judge at every time. Allen Ginsberg came and spent most of his time on the stand oming. And the judge said, why is he going om? I said, Your Honor, that's what he does to quiet people down. That's what he did in Lincoln Park during the Democratic National Convention. Well, tell him he can't om in a federal district court. With that, all hell broke loose, noise all over the place, and all I heard through the fracas as the marshals were clubbing people was, it didn't work inside any more than it didn't work in Lincoln Park the night the police went on a rampage. But we had a great trial. A lot of the people are still around. Some tragically are gone, like Phil Oakes. When Phil took the stand, he had his guitar on his lap. And we wanted him to sing what he would have sung had the police not driven him out of Lincoln Park during the Democratic Convention. He was going to do I Ain't Marching Anymore, which is a great song. The judge had the marshal clap his hand over his mouth, said there would be no singing in the United States District Court, and then had the nerve to tag the guitar with an evidence strip, which mean that guitar would stay in the courtroom throughout 7 months of trial. We went out and bought a little ukulele, and we took a tag, put it on as Exhibit BB for the defense, and sneaked Phil's guitar out of the evidence strip. So Phil could go his way, and we could go ours. When the judge saw the ukulele, he said, what happened to the guitar? And all I remember was Jerry Rubin say, it shrank. One of our best guests was Paul Krasny. Many of you know Paul. Sort of a flake, but an interesting one, which probably you can say about all of us. But when I put Paul on, he had been to Chicago during the Democratic Convention, and he was supposed to tell what it was like in Lincoln Park. But I saw when he went up to the stand that this man was bombed out of his mind. He had dropped acid in the men's room outside the courtroom. So I said, Mr. Krasny, what is your name? He said, I was born in Albany, New York. I nodded. Looked at my yellow pad, as if that was just the answer I wanted. And when did you come to Chicago? In August of 1968. Well, I tried out for the football team at the Albany High School, but I broke a finger, and I never made it. So I went out for lacrosse instead. I said, thank you. And then I said, when you were in Chicago, did you go to Lincoln Park? He says, my mother had this house up on State Street in Albany, which she sold, and we then moved to Schenectady. With the greatest look of triumph I could muster, I turned to the United States Attorney. I said, thank you, Mr. Krasny, your witness. Mr. Ferran, who was the United States Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, looked at his pad, hesitated, and then said, no questions. And I'm sure the jury thought that Paul had just given the key to the entire case. Now, you know, Abby, during the trial, refused to use the name Hoffman, since it was the judge's name as well. And he brought to me one day someone who was called Country Joe McDonald. Some of you have heard of Country Joe. Wonderful guy. The judge could never get the name McDonald. He thought his last name was Joe. But I said, Country Joe, will you take the stand? So in the record of the trial, there is no McDonald. There's just Mr. Joe. So Country never got his name, his full name, into the record of the Chicago trial. Getting away from Chicago, you know, I'm supposed to be a lawyer. You tell me that. I've done it for over 50 years. But I have a very low opinion, of course, of lawyers. And someone once asked me, in a very perceptive riddle, what the difference was between a lawyer and a spermatozoa. Well, I scratched my head, and I said, all right, I'll bite. What is the difference between a lawyer and a spermatozoa? And the person said to me, well, a spermatozoa has one chance in 6 million to become a human being. That has been my understanding of the legal profession. They're also a little wacky, a lot of them. They're sharks, of course. They charge with the traffic conveyor. They look and sound like charlatans. And I think they're all a little nutty in a sense. It reminded me of a story I heard today, talking about nuttiness, of three old men. These three old men were being interviewed for an aged home in the Bronx to see whether they would fit in. And the interviewer asked each one the same question. He said to the first one, how much is 3 times 3? And the first one said, 2,000. Mm-hmm. The second one was asked the same question. How much is 3 times 3? He said, 20. The third one was asked the question. He said, of course, 9. And the interviewer said, that's right, how'd you get that? By deducting 20 from 1,000. Now, the Simpson trial has degenerated. So I wanted to show you some of the entrepreneurs. This is Marcia Clark, which gives you a complete guide in cartoons to her life. On the other side is Robert Shapiro. There are ones for Cochran, that dinosaur Bailey, and everybody else that's into the act. The scorecard is 11 lawyers for O.J. and 9 for the prosecution. So O.J. should win the way the Mets won last night, 12 to 10, 11 to 9. But I have done a series of sonnets on this trial because it is producing more essential bullshit than any soap opera that's running. In fact, it's cut into the soaps, as you know. They're all waiting for it to be over so that the soaps can pull back the audience that's mesmerized by watching these endless cross-examination, endless openings, endless conniving, endless bench conferences. The judge, of course, is Judge Ito. Now, Judge Ito was selected because he's not black or white. They needed an in-between, and Judge Ito fits that category. The fact that his wife is a captain in the LAPD, or he was an assistant district attorney, probably had something to do with it, but they couldn't have a black judge, and they couldn't have a white judge. So you're stuck with Judge Ito, who sits up there with coffee cups, a computer, and all the paraphernalia of a surrealistic courtroom.
That was Bill Kunstler reflecting on the Chicago 7 trial.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.